We are studying the book of Genesis. I'm on page 70. We just studied a section where Abraham and Lot split because the herdsmen of Lot were arguing or fighting over wells with the herdsmen of Abraham. And Abraham gave Lot the choice. He said, "Let there not be enmity between us. We're kin. You're like a son to me. Try to be a father to you. So you pick where you want to live, and I'll go away from you so that we don't have enmity. If you want to live to the plains, I'll stay in the mountains. If you want to stay in the mountains, I'll move to the plains." And so Lot chose to go down to the plains to live. It was much easier. It was closer to market, had more benefits in terms of his lifestyle. And he left Abraham's covering and protection, which was both physical and spiritual, and went down there for an easier lifestyle. And it was a mistake, as we will see over and over and over again. It pays back in negative coin. But he did. And he had an opportunity to stay with Abraham if he was just willing to submit to him. Abraham had raised him since he was a toddler, and his prosperity over which they were fighting was due to Abraham's grace. It's always a problem when our prosperity becomes more important than relationships with the giver of prosperity, because it leads us into a place of destruction and defeat. So maybe we can learn from this righteous man Lot. The Bible tells us he was a righteous man. We're righteous people, yet we make mistakes. So just because we're rightly related to God doesn't mean we're incapable of making error. So let us pray that God will show us how to walk before Him. Genesis 13, verse 14, bottom of page 70. The Lord said to Abraham after Lot had separated from him, "Now lift up your eyes and look from the place where you are, northward and southward, eastward and westward, for all the land which you see, I will give it to you and to your descendants." How long?
Forever.
"And I will make your descendants as the dust of the earth, so that if anyone can number the dust of the earth, then your descendants can also be numbered. Arise and walk about the land through its length and breadth, for I will give it to you." Then Abraham moved his tent and came and dwelt by the oaks of Mamre, which are in Hebron. There he built an altar to the Lord. So God rewards Abraham's choices with temporal and eternal wealth. Having something does not always constitute ownership. Usage is often as good or better than ownership. It's one thing, as stewards, we're meant to use that which God gives us without having to worry about the problems of ownership. Owners are ultimately responsible. Good stewards are provided for and live well. So Abraham is told what all God is going to give him. The boundaries of it are laid out here, not for the first time and not for the last time. So it came about in the days of Amraphel, the king of Shinar, and Arioch, king of Elasar, Kedorlaomer, king of Elam, Tidal, the king of Goim. They made war with Bera, the king of Sodom, and Birsha, the king of Gomorrah, and Shinab, the king of Admah, and Shemeber, the king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, that is Zoar. All these came as allies to the valley of Siddim, that is the Salt Sea. 12 years they had served Chedorlaomer, but the 13th year they rebelled. In the 14th year, Chedorlaomer and the kings were with him, came and defeated the Rephaim in Ashtaroth-Karnaim, and the Zuzim in Ham, and the Emim in Sheva Kiriathaim, and the Horites in Mount Seir, as far as El Paran, which is by the wilderness. Then they turned and came to En Mishpat, that is Kadesh, and they conquered all the country of the Amalekites, also the Amorites, who lived in Hazes on Tamar, and the king of Sodom, the king of Gomorrah, and the king of Admah, and the king of Zeboim, the king of Bela, that is Zoar, came out. They arrayed for battle against them in the valley of Siddim, before the Salt Sea there, against Chedorlaomer, the king of Elam, and Tidal, the king of Goim, and Amraphel, the king of Shinar, and Arioch, the king of Elasar, four kings against five. Now the valley of Siddim was full of tar pits, and the king of Sodom and Gomorrah fled, and they fell into them. But those who survived fled to the hill country, and they looked, and they took all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their food and supply and departed. And they also took Lot, Abraham's nephew, and his possessions and departed, for he was living in Sodom. It seems like this world's always coming into and going out of a season when someone is trying to take over the world. And in this particular case, we had the four kings of the mountains who decided they were going to exercise hegemony over everything below them. And they made a very broad swath throughout all of Canaan, conquering peoples. They were a powerful army. And then they came to the Salt Sea, and there they encountered the five cities of the plains. These are the places, this place where Lot had chosen to go and live. And they captured the five cities of the plains, the four kings of the mountains. The kings of the plains fled and fell in tar pits. The people fled to the hills, those who weren't captured. They took all that they found there, the kings of the mountains took all they found there, and they herded it all back to where they were going, including the people of Sodom and Gomorrah, including Lot and his family. So what seems like a good deal sometimes isn't. So Lot has come down here for the purpose of enriching his life and avoiding the strife of dealing with Abraham's herdsmen, which was an easy thing to deal with versus this. And he's disconnected himself from his protector and allied himself with people who could not help him. And so these mountain kings who have at this particular point in time risen up in power to try to conquer the world around them have conquered him and taken him and his wife in exile back to where they were going to live, which would have resulted in them becoming slaves. Yes?
Wayne, just a temporal relationship here. How many centuries is this before they're banished to Egypt for 400 years?
Well, Abraham's around 2,000. Uh-huh. And when they're banished to where?
Egypt.
Babylon?
Babylon. Sorry.
Babylon is 605.
Okay.
About 1,400 years.
Okay.
Egypt's still ahead of them, but it's, you know, but Babylon is 1,400 years. So, you know, they go into, after Abraham comes Isaac, and after Isaac comes Jacob, and after Jacob comes Joseph, and Jacob's people go to Egypt. And that's about 1,400, about 1,500, well, actually 1,418, about 1,800. And then 400 years later, Moses comes along, and he delivers the people, and then they go forward, and they have the era of the judges. And after the era of the judges, they have the era of the king, starting with David. And then after the time of David and Solomon, you have the divided of the two kingdoms. 722, the northern kingdoms hauled off. 605 to 587, the southern kings hauled off. So you've got somewhere between 1400 to 1500. Lot has allied himself away from his covenant bearer, from his kinsman redeemer. And he's therefore gotten caught up in the politics and the issues. All of Lot's wealth-based choices have come to naught. He had disdained the allegiance with the protection of his kinsman redeemer, Abraham, God's covenant bearer, and it cost him dearly. Today, some people disdain the allegiance and protection of our kinsman redeemer, Jesus, God's final covenant bearer, and it will cost them dearly as well. Then a fugitive came and told Abram the Hebrew. Now he was living by the oaks of Mamre the Amorite, brother of Eshcol, the brother of Aner. And these were allies with Abram. So Abram's moved into Canaan, and he's come into the Amorite lands where three brothers have basically dominated the area. And he's become allies with them. He comes in as an alien. And he earns their respect, and they become allies, partners in many things. So the fugitive comes to this particular place. When Abram heard that his relative had been taken captive, he led out his trained men born in his house, 318, and went in pursuit as far as Dan. Abraham's, the size of his hegemony at this particular point in time is 318 men plus wives and children. So the 70 people that came out of Ur the Chaldees have now become maybe 1,000 people. And so he takes his 318 men to go and rescue his nephew Lot, who's been captured by the four kings of the hill country, who have captured all the nations around him and have defeated the five kings of the plains and their armies. And Abram has decided that he needs to go and rescue his nephew Lot. So Lot, who has abandoned Abram, finds in Abram someone who will not abandon him. And therefore, Abram is being, for us, a true kinsman redeemer. He's showing us what a kinsman redeemer does. And the people of this world who abandoned God found that God would not abandon them, but he sent his son Jesus to be their kinsman redeemer, to rescue them. And so it is. He divided his forces against them by night, he and his servants, and he defeated them and pursued them as far as Hobah, which is north of someplace here, hang on. North of Damascus. And he brought back all of the goods and all back his relatives with Lot in his possessions, and also the women, the people. So Abram and his 318 men, and we're told also that Mamre, Aner, and Eshcol went with their men as well. So there might be as many as 500 or so. Went up against these four great armies and defeated them somehow. Came in by night, apparently. You know, God has a habit of getting involved in these kind of battles where there's these massive armies, like the Assyrians, whatever, against the people of Israel, who outnumber them in great manner, coming into them and confusing them in the fog of war in the camps, and they wind up fighting each other and killing each other. This happens over and over and over through the scriptures. And this is an example where Abraham and 318 men, and whatever else the other guys brought, defeated this huge army that had defeated all of the countries around them. And Abraham defeats them, wins, and gets Lot back. Lot and actually all the people who came, were captured by Lot from the plain cities, and all the goods. We have a tendency sometimes to think that the troubles are monolithic. They're huge. They're bigger than we can imagine. And we've been here before. We went up against the Nazi regime that was apparently undefeatable. I mean, they were, you know, and many other places where we have been where God has helped us. We went up against the lobster backs of King George at the very beginning. A small handful of people against this, the Invincibles, the mighty army of the Brits. You know, the first British army that came over were actually Hessians, and they were hired. But when they got beaten, what happened is Wellington defeated Napoleon. Thank you. Wellington defeated Napoleon. And so they were sending Wellington and his Invincibles, the greatest army of the day, to America to rescue General Howe, who was an idiot. What happened is that Wellington said, "I believe that God is with them. I won't go." And so they sent Wellington's brother-in-law instead, and he was an idiot. And so they came over, and the Invincibles, who had just defeated Napoleon, were overcome and conquered by a handful of, you know, very small number of American colonists fighting from behind trees, etc., etc. The battle belongs to the Lord. It always belongs to the Lord. Now, on the other side of that, we saw the great United States defeated by the Vietnamese. You know, we got to where the only people we could take was the island of Grenada. We handled them pretty well. The battle belongs to the Lord. And when we align ourselves with God, then we align ourselves with his protection, covering his provision. When we don't, we wind up getting involved in the fog of war. We can't see straight. We can't shoot straight. We can't figure out what we should do. We find that a little handful of people can make our lives miserable. We got all these people here, all this power and all this strength. And a fairly small number of people over in the Middle East can totally make us absolutely miserable. Up until 9/11, we had not been attacked on our own shores since 1941. We had been invincible from all of that. Our intelligence systems, prevented all these things from happening. And then it all ended. And now we can't see anymore. At any rate, Abraham goes up with his 318 men and his handful of allies and defeats this great army. He resorts to nighttime raids and guerrilla warfare. He harasses them from Dan to Damascus. Now, Abraham is, you know, where Sodom and Gomorrah is. It's at the bottom of the Dead Sea. So if you go down to the Dead Sea, you got the Dead Sea, you got the Jordan River, it goes all the way up to the Sea of Galilee, okay? And from the Sea of Galilee, it goes up to Mount Hermon. So Lot and his people were captured from the area south of the Dead Sea. And Abraham defeats these people all the way up to Damascus, which is above Israel. It's above Syria. It's Syria and Lebanon. So he goes into Dan, which is the northernmost city, and from Dan to Damascus, he chases these people down, drives them off, harasses them, defeats them. So that's a pretty long battle. I mean, it's a pretty wide field. Even the Sodomites have benefited in this instance from their association with Lot and Abram. The Amorites, Mamre and his brothers, seem to know the Lord at this point. They have been impressed enough with Abraham to throw their lot in with him against this huge force. I mean, why would you do that? You know, this is not Mamre's and his brothers. It's not their fight. But they align themselves with Abraham. That's called being a witness. They align themselves with Abraham and they go after this massive army because they buy into Abraham. That's a witness. Lot should return home at this time to Abram. Everything he's had has been taken away. All of this stuff's been carried off. He's got nothing left. All he can do is move into the city and operate a small business there. And at this point in time, it would seem that he would do well to move back to Abraham. I mean, he doesn't have the problem of all of his servants fighting over wells because they're gone. But he doesn't. He stays in Sodom and Gomorrah because the new football stadium is going to be really good once they get it going. And you know, the shopping mall is going to be better now that the war is over, etc. And so he stays there. He isn't grateful enough, so he doesn't resubmit himself to Abram. This decision, or lack of one, will cost Lot even more in his original lapse in judgment. And Lot is a righteous man. Lot's a righteous man. He's a good man. But he's making some really bad mistakes here. And we're not incapable of those same mistakes. Sometimes we look at people in the Bible or whatever, and we kind of divide them into good guys, bad guys, you know, white hats, black hats, whatever. And we think that all the good guys always do the right stuff and all the bad guys always do the wrong stuff. But if Genesis teaches us anything, it's that people are a mixture. The good guys make mistakes and the bad guys are very often do the right thing. Because it's not about us being perfect, because none of us are or can be. It's about a relationship with God. That's the mechanism by which from which everything divides. With God, without God.
It seems to me that Lot was very enamored with his first breath, the last breath world, as opposed to seeing or asking God even if he should submit to Abraham. Because Scripture never, I mean, he might have, but Scripture never tells us that that occurred and he was just kind of...
You're right, it doesn't tell us. All we can do is draw conclusions from what we read. And the one big conclusion that I draw from this is that Lot is very much governed by his women. Well, he's taking his cue from his women. That's just what I observe when by the behavior of his daughters and his wife, etc., etc. Lot grew up as a child in Abraham's lap.
Yeah.
And his relationship with Abraham runs deep. So who knows? We'll have to ask him someday.
Yeah.
Hey, Lot, why were you so stupid? Hey, Wayne, your name's not written in the Bible. So anyway, the whole point about the The whole point is that these are normal human beings, like us. And many of them are good people who make mistakes. And we would do well to try to avoid those mistakes and learn from them. And to try to recognize what causes success and what causes failure. It's just a thought. These stories are they're real and they're meant to teach us something. That's the whole purpose for being here. It's our job is not to stack people into good guy, bad guy stuff. Our job is to see what they've done, learn from what they've done, etc., etc. He beats these people all the way to Damascus, and he brought back all the goods and also brought back his relative Lot with his possessions and also the women and the people. So Abraham rescues all these people, and from Damascus he brings them all the way back to the area of the Dead Sea. That's a wide-ranging fight.
At least multiple thousands of years later, there's not much down there.
Yeah. Well, after Sodom and Gomorrah, after the fall of Sodom and Gomorrah, the cities of the plains wind up in the bottom of the Dead Sea. But, yeah.
This is a map that shows, I'll hold it up. This is Damascus, and that's the Dead Sea, the bottom. So you can see.
Yeah, it's only that far.
Yeah, but that's this is the bottom of the Dead Sea right here.
It's almost the entire length of the country.
Up there where my finger is.
I mean, it's above the country, but Dead Sea is not at the bottom of the country. It's almost the entire length of the country.
Yeah.
You know, just to give perspective. Mm-hmm. Abraham doesn't hesitate to go. His men don't hesitate to follow him, and his friends don't hesitate to join him. This is an act of faith. This is why he's the father of our faith. He said, me and God are a majority. I used to tell you a story about my brother, Mike. He was 3 years younger than me. And he was small. He's a little guy. He had little man syndrome all of his life. And so he always get in these fights, and I'd always have to clean him up. And in fact, the only time he ever... He was tough. People would leave him alone because he made the fight not worth their while. He was all elbows and knuckles. But... You know, I would get involved from time to time because he didn't care what size they were. In fact, almost only fights I ever got into were because of Mike. And the only time I saw him ever get defeated was when he fought a guy his own size. There was no need for me to get involved with that. At any rate, two little scrappy hens or chickens and going at them. When Mike was little, about five-ish, I would say, he got a set of cowboy pistols, white-handled, black holster, whatever, and a red hat for Christmas. And so we went through this whole stage where he was the cowboy. And my dad was a grocer. He worked for Kroger for 22 years, and so we had plenty of sacks. So he would take the sacks and he would open them up and set them on the top all around the laundry room, which wasn't very big, really. And then he would go in there and he would just beat them to death. Bam! You know, he got his hat on, his guns. You know, he would just, until there was nothing left but shredded paper on the floor. And then he would come out and he'd go, he said, you know, he said, me and Roy Rogers about as tough as what I am. He and Roy Rogers could handle anything. Well, Abraham and God could handle anything. And that's true for us too. You know, we have cancer, we have old age, we have death, we have debt, we have all manner of things we have, but us and God can handle anything. We're meant to see this. So the Sodomites are blessed by their just casual relationship with Abraham through Lot, in that they're all brought home safely. All their goods are brought back with them, you know, for the most part. And we'll see this here in just a minute with the kings. So after his return from the feet of Chedorlaomer, where the kings were with him, the king of Sodom went out to meet the valley of Sheba, that is the king's valley. So the king of Sodom, who's been now rescued from his tar pit, is going out to meet Abraham, coming back with all of his citizens and his wealth, and etc., etc. Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. Now he was a priest of God Most High. And he blessed him and said, blessed be Abram of God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth. And blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies in your hand. And he gave him a tenth of all. Now this is a very small passage with a very big implications. The book of Hebrews tells us that Melchizedek was both, by definition, the prince of peace and the king of peace and the king of righteousness. That he was, and it says that Melchizedek had no parents. He had no lineage, neither mother nor father. In other words, Melchizedek was a Christophany. He was the appearance of God in human form in the Bible to greet Abraham as he came back. In fact, he was the appearance of Christ. A Christophany, where Jesus becomes a human being. So Abraham is back in his camp, and all of a sudden, in the early evening, comes this small caravan of three, we're told about. I don't know about the rest of them. But on it is this king. It's like one of the wise men that came to visit the stable. And his name is Melchizedek, which means Prince of Righteousness, Prince of Peace. King of Salem, Prince of Peace. So he greets Abraham, and Abraham recognizes almost immediately he's in the presence of God. So they sit down and they share what later becomes known as the grain offering, which is bread and wine. And they share bread and wine, the meal that is associated with Jesus. And when they share this, Abraham bows down to him and worships him. And Melchizedek does not prevent him from doing that. And Abraham gives him a tenth of all he owns, because that's how you acknowledge God, is by paying your tithe. And Abraham says, finally, I've got somebody I can hand this to. And so he gives him a tenth of all he owns. It's a little bitty small package passage, but it has a lot in it. And Abraham said to the king of Sodom, I have sworn to the Lord God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, that I will not take a thread or a sandal or thong or anything that is yours, lest you should say, I have made Abram rich. So after his meeting with Melchizedek, he says to the king of Sodom, who's come in, I'm not going to keep anything that belongs to you. I won't take any of it, because I don't want you to say that you made me rich. I don't want anybody to say that, because God is my source. God is my strategy. Early on, I was, the chapter we had before, I think it was. Yeah, this chapter. The title says, Hey Lot, the only viable strategy is God. I have a lot of fun with chapter titles. I have fun. The only viable strategy is God. God is my strategy. God is my strategy for winning, living, success, eternity, etc. God is my strategy. And God was Abraham's strategy. It was a strategy for war. It was a strategy for peace. And he threw himself in with that. And he did not allow himself to be enriched by the culture around him, which separates him distinctly aside from Lot in terms of how they approach all of that. Lot specifically went down so that the culture might enrich him. Abraham refuses to let the culture enrich him and therefore pollute him. And he trusts in God. When Abraham meets Melchizedek, he gives away 10% of what he has. He doesn't get suddenly richer. He gives away 10% of what he has, because he recognizes it belongs to God and he's just a steward. And he acknowledges God by giving him the tithe. That's what the tithe has always been about. And it predates the law, by the way. You see that? That the tithe actually goes back to the garden, but that it predates the law. We haven't gotten to the law yet. So the whole thing about giving the tithe is not part of the law. It predates it. When Jacob goes to flee from his brother and he's heading for Ur of the Chaldees so he can go visit Laban, his mother's brother, and he comes to this place and he's sleeping at night, and this ladder comes down out of heaven, Jacob's ladder, and God and the angels come down upon it. And Jacob realizes he's in a holy place, and he says to the Lord, if you will protect me, between now and the time that I return to this place, then you will be my God and I will give you a tenth of all that I own. He bargains with God. You know, these stereotypes are sometimes true. So he bargains with God. And sure enough, when he comes back to that particular place, he and God wind up having a wrestling match at that particular point in time. But he keeps his deal with God. And he gives him a tenth of all he owns, because that's how they acknowledged that this was God. So I will not take a thread or a sandal or anything that is yours, lest you should say, I've made Abram rich. I will take nothing except what the young men have eaten, and the share of the men who are with me, Aner, Eskel, and Mamre, let them take their share. I can't speak for them. Battles result in booty, and booty is shared by the victors. And Abram said, Aner, Eskel, and Mamre, they can take their share, but I will not take anything. So the Sodomite king offers Abram a great reward. It's not like he could take it away from Abram anyway. I'm going to offer you a great reward. All that you've captured, I'm going to give you a reward out of that. Abram decided, declined to be made rich by this pagan. God is his hope and his only strategy. Unfortunately, God was not Lot's strategy. Wealth accumulation and easier life was Lot's strategy. It did not serve him well. What is our strategy? I want to be God's friend. More than anything else, I want God, a relationship with God. And I was poor when I met God. And now I'm very well off. I mean, I'm not bragging, but I'm well off. We're Americans. We live in Alpharetta. I'm well off. But it's not mine, it's his, and he's what's important to me. For, this is the passage out of Hebrew. Oh, yeah.
So is this the first time we have heard about Melchizedek?
Melchizedek.
First time ever?
Yes. Because he's not a historical figure.
And he doesn't come up again until the passage in Hebrew?
That's correct.
So is he, I mean, I've just never known about this.
Yeah.
I'm like, is he an angel? Is he God?
He's God. He's Jesus. He's the second person of the Trinity who has come to visit Abraham in bodily form, which happens from time to time. Whenever God shows up in human form, it's called a theophany or a Christophany if it's Christ. And it happens a number of times. Remember, later, these three men come to visit Abraham in his tent and have dinner with him. One of them is God and two angels. When Joshua gets ready to cross over, he gets greeted by this huge angelic warrior. And he says, Joshua says to him, are you for us against? He said, neither, I'm the captain of the Lord's host. That's Christ. So God shows up in human form throughout the Old Testament from time to time in order to interface with them. God wrestles with Abraham, with Jacob as a human, as a man. And that's called a theophany or a Christophany.
But now, so King of Salem, there was no Salem?
No. Not yet.
Salem means peace?
Yes. Yeah, they're not yet. They're later, the city of Jebus becomes Jerusalem. Okay.
Is there any record of Melchizedek's birth or death?
No, actually, Hebrews tells us he didn't have one.
That's what I'm saying.
That he didn't have one.
I wonder how Abraham knew who he was, though.
Well, I don't know. When you're praying and the Lord shows up, you know. I mean, presence of the Lord can define itself. I mean, you've been in the presence of God. You've been in the presence of angels, probably. But you can walk up to somebody, or somebody can walk up to you, and almost instantly you know, this is a bad man. Or this is not a good person.
Is that what you still say about Ron?
Or somebody can walk up to you and say, you can say, this is the guy I'm going to marry. You know what I'm saying? Revelation. There's no substitute for revelation. All right, so he bought you off. But at any rate.
So how did the Jewish babies think it's God?
Oh, yeah.
They don't think so.
No. No, when the writer of Hebrews is talking about Melchizedek, he's telling the Jews something they already know. He's trying to make the point to them that Jesus's priesthood is after the order of Melchizedek, not after the order of Aaron. That's what the book of Hebrews does. It's a comparison between the Jewish prototypes and the fulfilled ministry in Christ. Old covenant, new covenant, old priesthood, new priesthood, whatever. And in the process, he brings up Melchizedek. And we'll read what he says here. But no, the Jews understand who Melchizedek is. They know who Abraham met. They know that Abraham gave him a tithe. Abraham's not... The king of Sodom is offered to give Abram a bunch of money. Abram turns it down. But he turns around and gives his tithe to a king who rides in on a camel he's never met before. Why would he do that? Because he knows he's in the presence of God. Finally,
Does Melchizedek have any special meaning in Arabic?
King of righteousness.
King of righteousness.
Yeah. Sedek, the word Sedek or Sadaka means righteous.
Okay.
Right, related. And Melek means king. And king of peace because he was supposed to be the king of Salem. Yes.
Are you saying that the Jews in the Old Testament understood this?
Yeah. They understand that he was God. They understand that Abraham... Yeah, they understand that Abraham... This is not... This is. They understand this. All of this.
Okay.
This is, you know... They read their Bibles. It was common to them. They knew this.
And the Jews today, those that practice...
Well, those who are evangelical Jews, they understand this. That when they look at this passage... Not, they don't look at Hebrews. But when they look at this passage, they know, they read what it says. They know what it says.
But the Jews in the Old Testament were not evangelical, were they?
Well, first of all, you can't be evangelical without a book to read.
Oh, yeah.
Okay? And so Moses hasn't written the book yet.
Right.
Once Moses writes the book and the people begin to follow the book, they become evangelical.
Okay.
Moses writes the book in 1400. The Old Testament goes on another 1400 years plus another 70 years into the New Testament because the New Testament people have no book to refer to but the Old Testament for the first 70 years. Okay, so from 1400 B.C. to 70 A.D., that's the Jews of the Old Testament. And those people know who Melchizedek is. In fact, one of the reasons we know that is because the writer of Hebrews is writing to Jews. And he's reminding them about Melchizedek. Right? Hebrews 7:1, "For this Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of the Most High God, who met Abraham as he was returning from the slaughter of the kings and blessed him, to whom also Abraham apportioned a tenth part of the spoils, was first of all, by the translation of his name, King of Righteousness, and then also King of Salem, which is King of Peace. Without father, without mother, without genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but made like the Son of God, he abides a priest perpetually." No father, no mother, no birth, no death. Pretty clear. God offers Abraham a chance to acknowledge him. God meets Abraham in the form of Melchizedek, and there God blesses Abram. This meeting is a Christophany, an appearance of Christ in the Old Testament. God offers Abram a table of bread and wine. This event is a precursor to both the grain offering promulgated by God to Moses at Sinai and the Lord's Supper promulgated by Jesus at the Last Supper. The grain offering, the bread and wine service at the Passover was the grain offering. There's five offerings, the grain offering. Hebrews tells us the priesthood according to the order of Melchizedek and the eternal priesthood in which Jesus participated versus the temporal priesthood of Aaron. He's got Aaron, Jesus, Old Testament, New Testament. It's don't leave Jesus and go back to the old. That's the whole point of Hebrews. Hebrews 7, verse 4, continue on. "Now we observe how great this man was, to whom Abraham, the patriarch, gave a tenth of the choicest spoils. And those indeed of the sons of Levi who received the priest's office have a commandment in the law to collect a tenth from the people, that is, from their brethren, although these are descended from Abraham." So the reason why the Levites collect the tenth is because it is an acknowledgement of who God is, as demonstrated by Abraham before them. Now, the whole point about the first fruits, and that goes back to the garden, the first fruits belong to God, and you acknowledge that it's all God's by giving the first fruits. By the time we get here, it's defined as a tenth, a tithe. But we're told that that's how you acknowledge God, and that makes it clear that you understand that he is a provider. And the Levites, who are, remember that when they got into the, when at Sinai it was decided that there would be one tribe who would be given in ministry, the Levites. Why was that? Well, God was, they owed God the first fruits of everything, including the first fruits of their loins, which means that the firstborn belonged to God. And in a simpler world, the firstborn would be the priest over all the people. But in a practical world, that didn't work well. So what happened is, and if we were ever studied Leviticus or, you know, Exodus, or Deuteronomy or Numbers, books that people like to duck, there's a ton of good information in there. And one of them is that God said to them, the firstborn belong to me. First of all, they belong to me because I'm God. Secondly, they belong to me because I spared your firstborn in Egypt by keeping the Passover, the angel of death, to cause them to pass over you. They belong to me. They're mine twice. But the thing is that you need your firstborn to run your families. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take the tribe of Levi in exchange for your firstborn. In fact, when they do that, they count the number of firstborn males and the number of the Levites, and they're 250 short of Levites. And so they go and they make, there's a whole mechanism for covering that 250. So every firstborn is accounted for and exchanged for a Levite plus this little thing on the end. The Levites then become God's ministers to the people. And they're not given land, they're spread out throughout the land so that they can minister to the people in the locales. A bunch of them are stationed around the tabernacle and later the temple, but the vast majority of them are spread out among the people so that the people will have a priest to do their sacrifices and all that sort of thing. And they are in substitution for the firstborn. They're the tithe of the firstborn to God. Now what happens is those people have to make a living. And while some of them have vineyards and everything, like John the Baptist's father, for instance, ran a vineyard. And if you go to Jerusalem, you can go to the place where John the Baptist is thought to have been raised and where the vineyards are. But Zachary ran a vineyard, but they have that. Most of them functioned as butchers, like Laser Wolf and Fiddler on the Roof. He was a Levite. But they had to be provided for, particularly the ones who were in the temporal and tabernacle work, which was a big bunch of them. So God said, here's what you're going to do with the tithe. You're going to take the tenth and you're going to give it to the tabernacle. And then they're going to distribute it among all the Levites to provide for them so that they can make a living. And they will be my ministers to you and your priest to me. And the tenth, which belongs to me, will be used to finance their work, and not just their work, but also caring for the poor and orphans and widows, etc., etc., at some level. And that's why we have paid ministry. Our ministers are the Levites. They are financed by the tithe of our offerings in direct command from God from the beginning. That's where all that comes from. Hebrews 7:4. Now observe how great this man was to whom Abraham the patriarch gave a tenth of the choicest spoils. Indeed, of the sons of Levi who received the priest's office have a commandment in the law to collect a tenth from the people, that is from their brethren, although they are descended from Abraham. So even though the Levites were descendants of Abraham just like all the other tribes, they nonetheless collected the tenth and used it to finance the ministry. Our ministers, men and women, are men and women like all the rest of us. They're like all the rest of us, but they're designated as those people who do ministry for us before the Lord, and we acknowledge God by financing what they do, that in the tabernacle, you know, the temple. Remember, they didn't go into debt to build the temple. They gathered what they needed, and then they built it. And when it came time to build the temple, people came out of the woodwork to donate money. If we go to read that story, one of the things we see is that there's a scripture in Psalm 110 where David says, "Thy people will volunteer themselves freely in the day of thy power, O Lord." In other words, when God's moving, people will get the checkbook out. Without any dispute, let's see here. Now see. So even though they were also descended from Abraham, but the one whose genealogy is not traced from them collected a tenth from Abraham and blessed the one who had the promises. So the person whose genealogy did not extend from mankind received Abraham's tithe, the one to whom the promises had been made. without a dispute, the lesser is blessed by the greater. In this case, the mortal man receives tithes, but in that case, the one receives them of whom it is witnessed that he lives on. So it is the God blesses his people. He blesses his people. The greater blesses the lesser, and the lesser acknowledges him by giving the tithe. He said, in the case of the Jews, they're giving tithes back to people who are people. But in Abraham's case, he gave tithe to someone who was eternal. And so, to speak, through Abraham, even Levi, who received tithes, paid tithes. For he was still in the loins of his father when Melchizedek met him. By tithing, we acknowledge that God is our provider, that we are stewards, not owners of what we have. We cannot fully acknowledge God as God unless we participate in tithing. It's the clear implication of what is said here. I'm going to stop here at this point. Don't tell Nancy. She'll think I've reformed. We're going to meet on 11:36. 15. Comments. But this story about Lot getting away from Abraham and wind up deteriorating because of it. Abraham being faithful, going to rescue him who had abandoned him. Trusting in the Lord, not in strength. Trusting in the Lord, not in wealth. Getting miraculously provided for all along the way. Coming back, acknowledging God versus these kings who all wanted to make him rich. You know, if you think about this, Abraham comes back with all this stuff. He could become big man on campus in five cities. I mean, he could spend the rest of his life being Abraham, the one who saved us all. Not interested. I'm going back to the mountains where I can be close to God, away from this culture here, because it is devastatingly destructive, as Lot will demonstrate to us going forward. Comments?
Was 1:10, was that Arabic or Greek translation? I mean,
Hebrew.
Hebrew.
Yes. Okay. The word tithe means a tenth. That's what it means. It's funny because I remember when I was a kid, they used to have the tithe in the Catholic Church. But they decided that, some people decided it could mean 5%. So they'd say, we're tithing 5%. Well, you know. In the Catholic Church, we had mandatory Catholic school systems. And so what happened is we needed to pay our ministers, which included the nuns with the bonnets, to educate all of our people, all of our children, so that they would be full-on citizens within that community. And so, yeah, they collected the tithe. What?
They pay their dues.
Well, it seems to me that it's so easy to identify with Lot. Like when we're making our day-to-day decisions, that we think of it from a worldly point of view as to what makes sense to us a lot of times without consulting the Lord.
We can. We sure often do. I mean, like for instance, should I buy this new car? Or should I learn to live with the one that I've got and take the extra money and do something else with it? Or
exactly. Should
I move or not move? Or should I buy a bigger house or whatever? Or, you know,
I think we're moving into a finer area, which would make our life easier. But the life easier might turn us from wanting to lean on the Lord.
Well, anywhere we move where God hasn't told us to move,
is a wrong
or anything we buy that God hadn't told us to buy, is not going to be helpful. Okay. So, yeah, we it's easy to pick on these people. Nancy was telling me today on the way over that you thought I was harsh on Jacob because I'm always on him about his knitting and, you know, being a wussy. And she thinks that I'm too harsh on Jacob. You know, she made that point. She's editing Genesis right now. And we had that discussion. But these people that we're studying are not perfect. They're not all bad. They're not all good. And what we're meant to do is to see that the great fathers of our faith are object lessons for us to learn from concerning how we should behave. So we can either sit back and give Jacob a grade, which is sometimes how we read the scriptures, or we could try to learn from what Jacob's life teaches us and therefore change the way we behave. And, you know, God's real. He's just as real now as he always was. And it's truth is truth. Doesn't care who has it. We might as well have it as well as anybody else.
500 years later, Moses came was Aaron and his kids part of the Levite?
Yeah, Aaron was, the Levites proceeded from Aaron's tribe. From Moses was a Levite, and the priest proceeded from Aaron's branch of the family. But all of Moses' family were Levites.
Okay.
All right, somebody pray us out.